the New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Hello again and welcome to the Country Hour. Coming up in the next hour, dozens of dead cows have now been found off the East China coast for a search for a missing live export ship, and dozens of crew, including two Australians, is underway.
Yes, yeah. It certainly looks that way. It's absolutely tragic. It's not only for the families, all the stock involved, everything. It's just catastrophic, actually.
We'll have more details on that live export ship, that missing live export ship, in about 25 minutes' time from now. You can always send us some comments about any of the stories on our program, 0467 922 684. That's a number to text me here at the Country Hour. But first up to water, because there hasn't been a water buyback for a couple of years and farmers have almost reached the cap set for the amount of water entitlement they can sell to the government under the Murray-Darling Basin Plan. But today, Water Minister Keith Pitt will commit to no more buybacks. He's expected to announce those changes to the Murray-Darling Basin Authority and funding for basin communities as he responds to two independent reports, one a socio-economic assessment and the other was the Water for the Environment Special Account Review. And prior to his, he'll be talking in the press club later on today, but before he did that, he spoke to our reporter, Kath Sullivan.
There will be no further water buybacks. So we will be focused on other options in terms of water recovery. We'll be focused on practical outcomes in terms of river health. And we are absolutely aware of what's happened throughout regional communities throughout the drought, and certainly as an impact as part of the Murray-Darling Basin Plan implementation over a long period of time.
So just on this issue of the water buybacks, the government hasn't carried out any buybacks from farmers for some time. So what is it that you're actually saying? What is it that's changing? Is this a legislative decision?
No, this is a policy position. There'll be no further water buybacks from farmers.
Are you making a change to the Murray-Darling Basin Plan?
No, we are not. We are committed to the plan. What I'm saying as Minister, I will not be buying any further water from farmers. We are looking for community-led solutions, and I'm certainly looking to get the almost $4 billion I have in accounts on the ground, and that's never been more important than now in the midst of the pandemic.
Do you have confidence that the Murray-Darling Basin Plan is on track?
Well, the WESA review, which I'll release tomorrow, very clearly states that we are behind. That is obvious, I think, to all of your listeners and those involved in the basin. But we remain committed to the plan.
Okay, but just to be clear, when it comes to no more water buybacks, this is a policy, not necessarily a legislative change.
This is the position of the Commonwealth Government.
But you're not changing the Murray-Darling Basin Plan?
I'm very clearly ruling out additional water buybacks from farmers. That is the position of the Commonwealth. It's the position of me as Minister. It's the position of the Coalition Government. And we have invested significant amounts in the Murray-Darling Communities Investment Package. That's $234 million to some very, very key economic packages throughout the basin, which will make a real difference, whether it's for the environment, whether it's for local regions and local communities, and it's an important change.
To the Murray-Darling Basin Authority, are you splitting it up?
We are making announcements around a compliance package as well. I'll be removing or shifting those individuals or those positions in the Murray-Darling Basin Authority involved in enforcement and regulation into a new Office of Water Compliance. We'll be combining the current Interim Inspector General's office with this new office. Those positions will be decentralised and located throughout the basin. This is a significant shift in terms of the Murray-Darling Basin Authority itself. I think it will also be warmly received. The Murray-Darling Basin Authority has done a very good job in a difficult policy area over a long period of time, but we want to ensure they're not marking their own homework, and this is about transparency.
So how many jobs will go from the MDBA to this new statutory authority?
Well, it'll happen over a period of time. Very clearly, we will need legislation to implement the new authority. So we'll stand up the organisation within the existing department. It'll take some time to move across and to set up those systems of government. It'll take some time to set up the legislation that's required to set up a new authority, but we are committed to it. I am announcing that today, and I think that's an important announcement around governance and certainly transparency.
Is there a timeline for this?
Well, as I've said, we'll work through that process. The Parliament has obviously been affected, like every other Australian and every other business, by the coronavirus pandemic. It has been challenging in terms of timing, but I've given a commitment very, very clearly that we'll be moving the regulatory provisions out of the MDBA, as recommended by the Productivity Commission in 2018, into a new Inspector General of Water Compliance. And I think that they will give comfort to a lot of your listeners that we will have this enforcement agent out in the field.
Would it be in the tens of jobs or hundreds of jobs?
Well, look, I'm happy to provide further detail on that.
And you mentioned that you're merging this new statutory authority with the Interim Inspector General for the Murray-Darling Basin, which is a position currently filled by Mick Kelty. Do you envisage that he would remain on as head of this new authority?
Well, we're working our way through all of those issues. I've certainly had a discussion with Mick Kelty, who's done a very, very good job with his report. We've accepted all five of those recommendations. We'll have more to say about who will lead this organisation at a later time.
It sort of sounds like you're giving his existing office more powers of compliance. Is that a fair assumption or not?
Well, that's correct. I mean, these are powers that currently live with the Murray-Darling Basin Authority. We are very clearly shifting them into a separate role in the Inspector General of Water Compliance. I think this is an important change.
Is there funding for this?
Yes, it will be funded. It is part of the $234 million package over the Fords.
That's the Water Minister, the Federal Water Minister, Keith Pitt. Well, the Commonwealth Environmental Water Holder has responded to Minister Keith Pitt's announcement that he's not looking to undertake any more buybacks from irrigators by saying that environmental water can in fact be saved with efficiency programs. More on that shortly. But first up, Jodie Swearpick also responded to the Wentworth report, saying it has started a youthful discussion of the issues affecting water in the basin, but more work needs to be done on how much water there is in the basin. Jodie Swearpick doesn't want to see a knee-jerk reaction to the 20% shortfall figure, but says we do need to start having a conversation about better managing what we have. I started out by asking her about her reaction to the Wentworth report.
So we always welcome improvements in the science and evidence base that underpins the basin plan, so very interesting to see this work come out. It helps us understand, you know, how much water there is to share. And there, when I said there's a few things to unpack there with the 20% less, we're really comparing a modelled scenario to what's actually happening on the ground. So there's always going to be a little bit of difference there. But we certainly support the central conclusion of this work that says that there's still yet to realise the full benefits of the basin plan, and that's for a number of reasons.
But also it's saying that, you know, if there is 20% less water, that has big implications for irrigated agriculture, big implications for the environment, and we can't get around that, or is there still a dispute about the figures?
Oh, look, I wouldn't say the figures are necessarily settled, so I think this work will lead into a number of other bits of work where governments are trying to understand if there's been a change in the hydrology of rivers in the basin, and there are some factors there where we know, for instance, in the Northern Basin, the drought that they've just experienced was actually harsher than the Millennium Drought.
So the irrigators that are saying, you know, we're in a drought, we didn't have any rain, let's not panic, let's not worry, we're going to get the water back, and it's not an issue. So are they right?
I support that in a way. I mean, we have been through a very extended dry period. The methodology of the Wentworth Group tried to cater for that. So they tried to look at 114 years of historic modelled conditions and compare what had happened in the last 7 years with some other years with the same water availability. So they tried to screen that out of what they're doing. But the, you know, irrigation community is right in terms that we have just been through a severe drought. We do have that, you know, over 2,000 gigalitres that have come to my outfit as the Commonwealth Environmental Water Holder, and we are actively managing that for the environment. So there is a big tranche of water that has been returned to the environment, and it's already making a difference.
So you're saying the jury's still out before any sort of government action, like we've heard from the Wentworth Group, they say action's needed now, we need to have a conversation now about this stuff, and action
Look,
needs
I
to be taken.
I think we do need to have a conversation now, but it'll take a while to actually further investigate what these changes are. If there is actually some step changes coming from climate change, that's going to take a while to wrestle with. So we do know the environment is getting a particular share. What this report is actually almost identifying is that there are other flows that would have come down the river, and there seems to be a case that those might have diminished. And whether that's about modelled versus comparing it with reality, or if it's about a drier climate, that's the thing that needs to be further investigated.
Now, the Water Minister, Keith Pitt, today has said no more buybacks. That's his... he's made that announcement today. But how would you get the water for the environment, the extra water for the environment would be needed if there weren't buybacks from irrigators?
What I think that the focus has been on is whether there can be further projects that are done on off-farm efficiency upgrades. So that's upgrades to things like irrigation channels.
So you think go for more efficiency measures rather than look at the buybacks? I mean, that's obviously what Keith Pitt is angling for as well.
Look, I think for the environment, the important thing is once water comes into the portfolio that I manage, it actually doesn't matter where it came from, whether that's from an efficiency upgrade or from the market, and that therefore that makes that a social and economic question, not an environmental question. So once I receive the water in my portfolio, it doesn't matter where it came from, and we're still able to deploy that water to get the best environmental outcomes.
So you're not worried 20% missing? You're not worried? You think, hold your horses, let's wait and see?
Look, I wouldn't say I'm not worried. I think that it needs further work to investigate where the 20% is coming from. And, you know, if it is a drier climate and that means striking, you know, we need to think about whether we've struck the right balance in future years, then that is something for future years.
But isn't the jury's not out on being a drier climate or global warming anymore, though, is it? I mean, that's a given, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is. And so therefore I would say that that's actually probably one of the things that's leading to this 20%.
So not like cutting licences or cutting back allocations or cutting water to the environment, you know, by the 20%?
Look, I think it's too early to do that. Those licences, I mean, their property rights, whether an irrigator...
Yeah, they have to be paid compensation for it, yeah.
That's right. So that's a big step if we were ever in that situation, and I would say that we would need a lot more evidence and a lot more investigation of what the factors were than this preliminary analysis. I think this is a good analysis, and it's good that a group outside of government is actually putting this on the table to make sure people are thinking through and unpacking the issues. But I don't think that, you know, there's a change tomorrow.
Jody Sweerpick is the Commonwealth Environmental Water Holder. You're listening to The Country Hour, and it's 18 past 12.
You're listening to The Country Hour
on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Well, that Wentworth report found that 20% of the water that should be flowing in the basin is missing. Of course, it has policy implications for a range of things. Yesterday, we heard from New South Wales Water Minister Melinda Pavey saying that New South Wales is managing the water well. But Australian National University environmental scientist Professor Jamie Peacock disagrees with that assessment.
If there's a problem at the bottom of the river, it's because those at the top haven't been managing it well. New South Wales management of the river system has been appalling. There's a whole lot of agreement in the Murray-Darling Basin Plan that New South Wales has promised to implement that it hasn't. It was meant to have fixed floodplain harvesting before now. It's very belatedly that they're getting around to metering the take of water, and then they haven't got on with the job of relinking the rivers to the floodplains, which is critical for South Australia because, you know, without being able to send down a pulse of water down the rivers, then we won't get the beneficial watering and flushing effect on the floodplains in the South Australian Riverland.
There's going to be, as you said, some hard choices that do have to be made in light of this. What needs to change?
Well, I think the first thing is that our governments need to actually start measuring what's in the rivers properly and accounting for any gap. So we as taxpayers through the federal government, of spending $13 billion reforming water management. I think it's unfortunate that a group of scientists have had to come up with this report. It should be our governments who are comparing how much water is in the river each year against what they modelled should be in the river to find out if there is any gap, why that is, and working out what to do about it. So getting our governments to actually measure the rivers properly and report against it publicly is a critical step to better management.
Well, Jamie, just on that, what water models has the government been using to monitor the amount in the basin?
Well, the current basin-wide model that's used for the Murray-Darling Basin is a patchwork of different state government models that have been roughly bolted together. And it's a very creaky and out-of-date model. It hasn't been updated since 2009. And since 2009, a number of the upstream states changed management rules. So, for example, New South Wales changed rules to allow irrigators to pump water out of the Darling more easily. And so the models that are being used are out of date. Of course, the models weren't adjusted to take account of climate change. And so it's really time for the federal government to insist that all the governments build a new model that actually works, make it public, maintain it, and use it every year so the community can see whether we're getting value for the dollar.
Do you think, given this report and previous ones we've seen highlighting multiple issues with the Murray-Darling Basin Plan, do you think the plan needs to be abandoned? Is it doing its job?
No, the plan shouldn't be abandoned. There's some really good elements in it. If the upstream state governments were to implement their commitments properly.
That's ANU Environmental Professor Jamie Pittock speaking there to Isabella Pittaway. You're listening to The Country Hour, 22 minutes past 12. Well, Northern Irrigator Groups say New South Wales is well advanced in monitoring water use in the Murray-Darling Basin and has questioned the integrity of the report released by the Wentworth Group of Concerned Scientists. The study, of course, claims 20% of the water in the basin that should be there is missing. That's about 2 trillion litres, or 4.5 times the volume of Sydney Harbour. Zara Lewine is the executive officer with Guida Valley Irrigators, and she told Amelia Bernasconi the drought has had a huge impact and water simply hasn't been available.
I think the report underestimated the complexity of water management and a range of things. And I think the important aspect is, you know, we have had a very dry sequence, a 1-in-100-year drought sequence, and so we have to appreciate that there hasn't been the water available upstream or downstream, and so that has frustrated communities everywhere. But then we have to think about, it does point to some of the aspects where we are seeing a transition and a finalisation to some of those areas, whether it is the licensing of floodplain harvesting. So that'll be due by the middle of next year. We're seeing reforms in the metering aspect, so there's more confidence around what that is being measured. And we've seen the investment in NRAR and the activities that they've put. So they're all about bringing confidence to the community and to water users that everyone's just getting their fair share. But the way water management works in Australia, in particular in the basin, is it allocates water when it's available. And if it just isn't there, we can't allocate it and it can't be used.
Can you tell me a little bit about, you know, your group across the Guida Valley? Yeah, what are people using here? You know, do they like the basin plan as it is?
I think we see the evidence of the basin plan in action. And so we have a significant amount of environmental water, and it was purchased back quite early in the recovery program. And we're looking now at having about half of the water available in Copeton Dam is in irrigators' hands and in the environment's hand as we speak. And then they're making decisions on how to use that going forward in this current season. But we've also seen the benefits of that, particularly in the last drought, where we saw the midsections to upper sections of the river run through environmental water. We got to coordinate those deliveries with our irrigation deliveries, so we were able to secure water to our high security farms, and that's really good outcomes. Plus, we've seen northern connectivity events and the fish flow events that have been happened only because of the water that has been purchased back for the basin plan. Now, that's come at a cost to our community and industry, but we have seen the benefits of it as well, and everyone does recognise those, and we do celebrate it.
Zara Lowen from Guida Valley Irrigators, and the graziers on the Darling, they're not happy with the way that the Wentworth report is being attacked and misrepresented. Stuart Laliva is a grazier and also Vice President of the Australian Floodplain Association. He says all water users need to come to grips with a drier climate, less water, and that big changes will need to be undertaken.
Yeah, I think the same old chestnuts have arisen again. Firstly, in relation to the compliance and the alleged theft of water, you know, look, maybe it's part of the problem. It's a very small and minute one, and it's been dealt with by NRA, and also there's obviously ICAC have been involved in it. So we think that the end of the day should be left where it is. The issue about drought came up again. Now, my understanding is that the Wentworth Group of Scientists accounted for the drought. So, you know, from Michelle to say something like that, we just don't agree with it.
The other issue she raised was climate change, global warming. She said, you know, we live in a country with droughts and flooding rains, and people need to recognise that and realise that. And she says she thinks about that every day. What's your response to that?
Michael, we've been maintaining for a long time that the bucket of water is no longer as full as it used to be, and you know, the inflows aren't there anymore. Now, whether it's because of there's two issues maybe, whether it's through the floodplain harvesting issue, through interception, it could be through modern farming practices now, it could be climate change, right? Once it gets into the stream, there is no connectivity between valleys. There is certainly not enough protection for low flows, and also you add climate change to it, because mostly we're dealing with dry riverbeds. So you put all those three, some of those factors together, and you can understand why the water's not there.
But you've been maintaining, and your group's been maintaining, and you've seen it yourself on the ground. You think that 20% figure, that's about right, or may even be a bit optimistic.
Well, I think it's personally, I think, and I've got nothing to base this on from experience and everything else. I think once you take floodplain harvesting issues and that into it, I think it's probably more. But, you know, but the Wentworth Group of Scientists have used the MDBA modelling and et cetera, and put, real figures and everything into it, and this is what they've come up with. So for the time being, we'll go with the 20%.
Stuart Oliva is a grazier. He's also Vice President of the Australian Floodplain Association. Got a few texts on the water issue. Keith Pitt's announcement, there aren't going to be any more voluntary buybacks. Someone said, great work, Keith Pitt. And someone's also texted in saying there were voluntary buybacks from willing sellers, costing the taxpayer far less than the billions spent on those efficiency projects that return little water to the environment. Yet again, it's the downstream communities and the environment that will suffer. Wonder if Keith Pitt has had some legal advice on this. Also, someone else has texted in, Greg, similar vein, water infrastructure saving schemes. They save water for irrigators, not the environment. Irrigation schemes are dressed up to benefit the environment. And Rex has texted in from Southern Riverina saying that the phrase marking your own homework that Keith Pitt used, that's a phrase that was coined by Southern Riverina irrigators 6 years ago. He says hopefully we'll finally get some recognition and hopefully a solution about the division within the MDBA. 29 minutes past 12, we'll go to news headlines shortly, but before we do that, the winner of the prestigious New South Wales Young Auctioneers is local auctioneer Ben McMahon. The competition's normally held at the Royal Easter Show in Sydney, but the event was cancelled due to COVID-19 restrictions. Our reporter Lucy Thackray was there alongside a lot of cows to hear the competitors go head-to-head.
Hey, he stands tall and he's proud too, isn't he? Hey, right, for that's here, there, center right, 14, I'll be 90, God, I'll be 390.
The prestigious New South Wales Young Auctioneers competition would normally take centre stage at the Sydney Royal Easter Show, but this year the cancellation of the show due to COVID-19 means the gift gab was battled out at the Dubbo Sale Yards yesterday. Competition judge Nick Hannaford from Australian Livestock and Properties Agents Association says it's not necessarily a bad thing to bring the competition back to the bush.
The contestants will sell on the rail, which they're probably more accustomed to, whereas selling in Sydney, they're on a bigger stage. You're selling prize-winning steers or stock to some higher-end markets, I would suggest, whereas today it's a more probably more natural environment, typical of what you would see in a day-to-day running of a sale yard operation.
What are you looking for in this competition as a judge?
There's a number of different things you'd be looking for, but I think for me personally, I'll be looking at their relevance in around the animal that they're selling, like being in around their values that they're putting on the stock, then obviously their diction and their clarity of voice and their projection.
And we've obviously got 10 competitors today and they've come through a long process. How do you think it might change the way that they present themselves to be doing it after the live market, the actual market, and in this type of platform?
Look, I think hopefully they've all 10 competitors, and firstly I'd like to congratulate them all. They're 10 that have been selected out of 23 to start with, so they've all already been through a selection process. Today, if they've been doing their work, their homework, they would have assessed their cattle already and they would have been following the market. Whereas in comparison to Sydney, they're going in somewhat blind. So I would be hoping that that will make them feel a little bit more at ease and go about their trade.
I'll be 380, going to be 1, going to be 81, going to be 1, going to be 2 bit. I'll be 382, going to be 2 bit, number 2 got. I got 383, the one of the mania.
The winner of the New South Wales Young Auctioneers competition this year was Ben McMahon from Inverell. Runner-up was Sam Smith from Forbes.
We weren't going to have the competition at all. ALPA have done their best efforts to get it across the line, so it's a great thing. I mean, it's really good to be a part of these things.
And Sam, how about you? So obviously it was a bit of a different format this year because you had to wait through the whole, you know, live sale, the cattle sale today. How did you feel?
Yeah, it was actually a bit nerve-wracking just waiting for the sale to go through and whatnot. But I've been in this 3 times now. This is my 3rd go and it's been a long time coming. A lot of hard work going into it behind the scenes, and yeah, it's good to finally get there.
Thank you, boys. Thank you, vendors. I'd just like to thank ALPA for allowing me to be here today. Thank you very much.
A round of applause there for Ben McMahon, who's the New South Wales Young Auctioneer this year, the winner of that prestigious award. You're listening to The Country Hour. Time to get some news headlines now from Adam Storey. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Michael. Well, National Cabinet is meeting today with the states under pressure over border closures. The Commonwealth will seek to get the states and territories to agree on a national system of what is a COVID-19 hotspot. But Queensland Premier says she will stand firm on her decision to keep the Queensland border closed until the end of the month. Health authorities in New South Wales have confirmed 8 new cases of the virus in the 24-hour reporting period. One of them is a return traveller and the other 7 are all linked to known clusters. 81 new cases have been recorded in Victoria. There's also been another 59 deaths though. And in other news, Japan's Coast Guard has found the body of a man in its search for survivors of the missing live export ship, which is believed to have sunk. Another ship has started finding livestock floating in the ocean, and conditions are calmer at the moment, but another storm is on the way, so they're rushing to cover as big a search area as they can. And the ABC understands that preliminary approval has been given for New South Wales school formals to go ahead in Term 4 after negotiations between independent schools and the state government. New South Wales Health will release details over the weekend, and it comes after nearly 50,000 students signed a petition calling for the ban to be lifted. And, of course, this took me back to my school formal.
So is that your Friday funny?
How quickly formalities became informal.
And you're formal.
Yes.
Well, that's another story for another day, I'd say.
I can't remember where we went for it.
I can't. I remember my school formal as well. The old, getting out the velour suit. And
the measuring up a couple of weeks before.
All that stuff.
Up at the local town.
Well, I won't be telling my son about that because, you know, he needs to concentrate on his exams.
Is he in a formal
HSC,
year?
HSC, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah.
He'd be more worried about that than anything else, probably, knowing him. All right, thanks for that, Adam. We'll talk to you later.
Okay.
You're listening to the New South Wales Country Hour. It's 25 minutes to one. Let's find out what's happening with the weather details. And Gabriel Woodhouse is there. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. How are you today?
Very well. So any sign of any rain at all, or is the system sort of moving through the state?
So overnight we saw a number of storms that extended out from about Cowra out to about Cobar, and in terms of rainfall totals, generally only a couple of millimetres, although around Goulburn managed to pick up 10 to 15 millimetres, so the highest was 15 millimetres at Pomeroy in the 24 hours to 9 o'clock this morning. Since 9 a.m. that band of showers and some thunderstorm activity has been mainly sort of confined to the central tablelands and out through Sydney and parts of the Illawarra, and rainfall totals again are only sort of sitting on the couple of millimetre mark. And that's pretty much what we're going to see over the course of the afternoon as that starts to spread a little bit further north through parts of the Hunter and up towards the northern inland towards the Queensland border. But as we get in tomorrow, that area of thunderstorm and showers is really going to shift towards the northeast, where in the afternoon we could see some isolated storms along the northern ranges there that could potentially produce some gustier winds during the afternoon.
Right, but not much rain by the sound of things.
No, not too much at this stage. You know, a couple of millimetres like what we've been seeing, and I mean, you might be lucky underneath a thunderstorm and pick up to about 10 millimetres, but at this stage, much more than that is not looking all that likely, except for maybe in the very far northeast on Sunday once we start to see some more persistent shower activity up towards the Queensland border, but elsewhere pretty much missing out.
And looking further ahead, what can we expect?
So looking further ahead, once we see that change moves the way all the way through to the northeast, we'll see a couple of showers along the coastal parts, but rainfall totals are going to remain quite light. And we'll start to see conditions really warming up during Monday and Tuesday. Tuesday in particular, with quite a few places seeing maximum temperatures, anywhere between about 5 to 10 degrees above average, especially across the western inland on Tuesday. And that's going to give way to a much cooler day come Wednesday. But we are also going to see some gustier winds across the southeast on Tuesday. But rainfall totals, again, remaining quite light. The only thing I can really see in the sort of longer term is we'll see another system move through during the second half of next week, which, depending on how the upper level structure works, we might end up seeing some more shower activity across the northern ranges and also out through the northwest slopes and plains. So that would be the next period to keep an eye on going into the end of next week.
Okay, so there may be some rain in that system, or it's too early to say.
There's a bit of movement at the moment in terms of some of the computer guidance, but some of the latest model runs have started to hint at just a little bit more rainfall across the northern ranges and across the northern half of the northwest slopes and plains. But it doesn't look at this stage that we'll see particularly high widespread totals, just more potentially up around that 15 millimetre mark at best if we do see this. To be honest, in these sorts of situations, particularly when we're looking about a week out, things can change quite rapidly over the course of the next couple of days as to how everything starts to settle down in some of that guidance for the longer term.
Okay, right, we'll wait and see. Thanks for that, Gabrielle.
My pleasure.
It's 22 minutes to one here on the New South Wales Country Hour. Got a few texts coming through, and someone's texted in, how about an independent scientific body to look at our precious water systems? That's on the in response to the Wentworth report. On the Murray-Darling Basin changes, someone's texted in saying the plan is well behind target. The federal minister is playing musical chairs with the bureaucracy. Meanwhile, he's destroying our livelihood. Another text comes through saying, yes, it's true. The Wentworth Group is intent on destroying irrigated communities. And someone's texted in saying it's criminal how the LNP have distorted and manipulated the basin plan to the extent that it's actually doing the opposite to what it was meant to do in the first place, that is to protect the environment. And what else? There was another text coming through saying we must ban floodplain stealing. Where do you think the 20% of that missing water went? It's 21 minutes to one on the New South Wales Country Hour. Now, we heard in the news that dozens of dead cows have been found off the East China coast, where the search for a missing ship carrying dozens of crew, including two New Zealanders and two Australians, is still underway. The Gulf Livestock One has been missing now for more than 48 hours off the coast of Japan. 43 people were on board, thousands of livestock. One survivor has been rescued. And Japanese authorities, as we heard in the news, have just picked up someone floating face down in the waters off southwestern Japan this morning. And another patrol boat this morning found a life jacket with the name Gulf Livestock on it. Bill Sweeney is a New Zealand livestock agent who had cattle on the ship, and I caught up with him a short time ago. Now, Bill Sweeney, you've actually got some cattle on this ship. We still don't know the whereabouts of it.
Correct. Yeah, we would have. Well, we would have supplied cattle to the exporting company that would be on that ship.
And what do you know at this stage?
Not a lot, actually. Only the fact that looks like it's capsized. One survivor that they know. So I haven't heard of anything anything more than that. It sounds like it one engine went down, hit by a double wave, I think, by the sound of it, and capsized it. And that's pretty much all I know.
And then it sort of disappeared off the radar then?
Correct, yeah.
And so it looks as though all the cattle have been lost and quite a number of the crew.
Yes, yeah, yeah, it certainly looks that way. It's absolutely tragic. It's not only for the for the families, all the stock involved, everything, it's just catastrophic, actually.
Terrible tragedy. And have we ever seen anything like this from New Zealand before?
No. I've been involved in the stock game for over 40 years. Been involved in a hell of a lot of export over that period of time. Never, ever in all the boats that have ever gone from here ever had anything like this happen before. You know, it's just, like I say, I don't know, just absolutely freak whether it was that typhoon. No doubt, I just heard on the radio earlier that it was, I think, a Hurricane 4 status type scenario, 200-plus kilometre-hour wind, so pretty horrendous.
And they also the issue you didn't never had any issues with any of the ships, like, you know, the of being poor quality.
No, we haven't actually. Like I say, the export has come a long way from where it was probably 20 years ago. They're very well scrutinised. You know, we have a lot to do with the exporters and the quality of the cattle that come off the other end. You know, a lot of them actually put weight on in their journey, so they've got, you know, there's been a lot of work done on the nutritionists and their feed. And everything and the handling. I've had guys on the boat before with them as stockmen, and there's certainly the stock are very well cared for. Absolutely no issue there. It's like it's just only got better and better, and the fatality on boards is just minimal. So, you know, there's a hell of a lot of work's been done over the years.
And in terms of the trade, do you think this now will put a spanner in the works for the trade, the live export trade?
Look, I'd be disappointed if that was the case. Like I say, thousands of boats, you know, have left shores from different countries, and for the, you know, for one to be the catalyst of stopping live export, I'd be pretty disappointed. You know, like there's no two questions about it. This is an absolute tragedy, but it's still got to be, you know, held in context to a certain degree, in my opinion. And you know, we have planes that crash and pretty frequently, and we don't stop planes from flying. And you know, this is a one-off freak in my opinion, and it's you know, if this had been happening on a regular basis, I'd be saying you definitely need to have a serious look at this. But no, I'd be disappointed if they thought that this was going to be the end of exporting. You know, it's worth a lot to you know, a lot of people. It's, you know, some countries depend heavily on you know, stock from New Zealand, Australia being carted to their countries and for a one-off, which looks like a freak accident, to cease all that, I think it would be wrong.
And
that's my personal opinion.
These were all New Zealand cattle?
Yes, they would have been, yes. Yeah, as far as I know, I don't think it was a joint ship. It was all loaded here.
Which does happen occasionally. And in terms of the number, do you know how many of them there would have been on the ship?
A few rumours running around. I think it was over 5,000, I believe.
And only one human survivor at this stage, so that means over 40 fatalities.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's the worst part about this. You know, the families that it's going to affect, it is horrific.
Bill, appreciate your time. I know you're busy. Thanks for that.
Okay, good as well, mate.
Well, still on that missing livestock export ship today, as we heard in the news, a man's been found floating face down in the ocean as the Japanese Coast Guard continues its search for survivors who might have been on board Gulf Livestock 1. Peter Somerville got the latest from our Japan correspondent Jake Sturmer just a short time ago.
Yeah, Peter, unfortunately, Japanese authorities have found a person floating face down as part of this search in their waters off southern Japan. It's in the area where the live export ship is feared to have sunk. Now, what officials are saying is that he is not conscious and is being taken to hospital. However, in the Japanese system, people are not pronounced dead until they are medically examined. So it is quite an ominous development. The man was picked up around 6:30 this morning, but his nationality is not known. We don't know where he came from. We know that there are two Australians who are on board, two New Zealanders and 39 Filipinos. One of those Filipino men was rescued on Wednesday evening. He was spotted by a patrol aircraft from the Coast Guard, and then a ship was able to pick him up, and it was some quite choppy waters and choppy conditions because a powerful typhoon had just passed through that area. And what he told authorities was that the engine on the ship cut out and then a huge wave hit the ship and it capsized and sunk. He threw on a life jacket. He was told to put on a life jacket and then jumped into the ocean and he hadn't seen any of his fellow 42 crewmen since. Now with the finding of this man floating face down this morning, that's the 42nd, but there are still 41 people missing, and authorities are searching and have been searching throughout the night to try to find them.
And of course, there's more bad weather coming for this part of the world as well. Are authorities hopeful that they will be able to find more of the crew members before the conditions deteriorate again?
Look, I think there's certainly a lot of hope that they will find these crew members and find them alive. They on Wednesday night when they spotted this Filipino crew member, they also found a lifeboat. They spotted it by air, but they haven't been able to locate that at sea, and they haven't seen it since. So there is this lifeboat that they haven't been able to find. But there is, of course, this typhoon, another typhoon to the south of Japan that is due to pass through the search area over the weekend. So it really is an extraordinary race to try to find people now while conditions are quite good. And the conditions at the moment, while at the beginning of the search on Wednesday, from Wednesday morning when the ship first put out its distress signal, they were pretty choppy because there was the remnants of another typhoon, Typhoon Maysak. But there is now a little bit clearer. It's still choppy, but visibility is much better. And so authorities are able to search. They have already, they've reported finding dozens of cattle from the ship. There were 5,800 cattle on board the ship, and authorities both last night and this morning say they have seen dozens of cattle. But of course, the race at the moment really is to find those 41 crew members before that typhoon passes through, that next typhoon passes through over the weekend.
And we've heard that there's been some issues with this ship previously, some mechanical issues?
Yeah, that's right. Most recently, in July this year, one of the ship's engines broke down in waters south of the Philippines. The Philippines Navy had to come and assist the ship. That was in late July, and that marries up with the engine problems that the Filipino chief officer reported to the Japanese Coast Guard. But also in May 2019, this ship, the Gulf Livestock 1, was detained in Broome before it was to sail to Indonesia. And the Australian Maritime Safety Authority found serious deficiencies related to navigation and the electronic system that's used to plan and display and monitor the ship's voyage. They found that officers weren't trained to use this electronic navigation system, that it contained out-of-date information about navigational hazards, and as a result, they weren't actually using this electronic navigation system. So AMSA just determined that the ship wasn't being safely operated. They held it until those issues could be rectified, that the crew members could get that extra training and get the systems updated. They did that, and another audit was carried out and determined that the ship could sail to Indonesia, which it did successfully in May last year. But it just goes to a bit of a questionable history about this ship, the Gulf Livestock One.
Okay, Jake, it certainly sounds like an ominous situation, but thank you for your time for the update on the Country Hour.
You're welcome.
Jake Sturmer is the ABC's North Asia correspondent. He was speaking there with Peter Somerville. It's 10 to 1.
The New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Well, Queensland Premier Anastasia Palaszczuk says Moree is being added to the state's border bubble. Chief Health Officer Jeanette Young says she's now satisfied the town is safe for residents to travel to. This could change, Dr. Young said, but at this point in time, New South Wales does have control of their outbreak. Mungindi residents and boarding schools in Toowoomba have been calling for the town to be added to the zone in the wake of Mungindi's main street fire earlier this week that destroyed essential shops and also ahead of the school holidays. This, of course, comes ahead of harvest time. We've seen agriculture permits introduced by the Queensland government too, but this will help if you're heading that way or if you're in the north of the state as well. So that announcement, Queensland Premier Anastasia Palaszczuk saying Moree has been added to the state's border bubble, and also National Cabinet is meeting at the moment, so hopefully we'll have some updates about any other changes to those permits. The agriculture work code permit is on the table at that meeting, I gather. We should hear about that later on this afternoon. It's 9 minutes to one on the New South Wales Country. We'll go to markets soon, but before we do that, confidence is sky high in the cattle market, with one stud in the southeast recording its best sale result. Hazeldene, near Cooma, of course, it's famous. They held their annual spring bull sale yesterday, and farmers travelled from across New South Wales to attend. Our rural reporter Josh Becker was there, and he filed this report.
$10,000 down to $10 off it. That's $10,000.
My name's Bea Litchfield, and I'm the stud stock manager here at Hazeldene, sixth generation Litchfield.
How did the spring bull sale go today?
We've been really happy with the spring bull sale. It's the last bull sale of our five sales for the year, so we've sold a total of 412 bulls. So it's great to end on a high. It was the best one of all of them, so it's been a good result.
The top price was $22,000. The average was $10,910. How's that result for you?
Well, it's the best sale we've ever had, Josh, so it's great.
Yeah, you must feel really happy with that. Is it because of the buoyancy in the cattle market at the moment? Is there good confidence there, or is there something that's different about the cattle this time around compared to the other sales?
Well, I think there is a lot of confidence in the cattle market, which is a good thing coming on the back of so many dry years. There's a lot of heifers around, a lot of people joining heifer bulls, and we've focused on calving ease, growth, carcass, so you know you get the whole package with the bulls that you buy here. I think a lot of people during the drought cleared out their bulls as well, so there's a bit of a bull demand too, so it's lined up for a lot of people across the stud industry, so it's been a good year.
Positive carcass data on in 2, ladies and gentlemen, 2.4 on the IMF 12.
My name's Stuart Greenhill from Talmalmo.
And Stuart, you've been here at the Hazeldene Spring Bull Sale today. Have you bought some bulls so far?
I bought four bulls and one for my brother, yes. And have bought bulls here previously before, but never came to the sale. I was always on Auction Plus.
What have you made of the sale so far?
It's strong, but it's a good sign for the cattle industry. A lot of heifer bulls making good money, which is a good sign that a lot of people are going to be joining up and getting going for the next season. Hopefully everyone gets a good season and gets going.
What about the prices today? How did they fit compared to other years?
Oh, they're up a fair bit, but that's good to see. That's people have got confidence in the industry. Yeah, they're up probably $3,000 or $4,000 on previous sales, but people are prepared to pay, and we're getting a good return for our article at the end, so it's all good.
How's the season at your place?
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah, we're having a really good season, and it's all going very well.
Can you give us a sense of your farm and what you run on it?
I'm just all black cattle. We wife and myself probably got, I'm not sure how many cows we'd have on, but yeah, it's we just grow steers out of the feedlot to 400 kilogram sort of plus steers to the feedlot, yeah.
What about your thoughts on the cattle market? Prices in the sale yards pretty strong at the moment. What are your thoughts on the outlook?
Yeah, I hope it stays the way it is. I just think it's probably a little bit high to sustain for stall cattle, and the world's pretty unstable at the moment. I'm slightly worried about our overseas buyers, which is China. I'm really worried about that, but hopefully it all settles down and people can get great returns for all commodities, not only beef, but yeah, wheat and wool, and hopefully they'll come back, and lambs as well.
That was Stuart Greenhill from Talmalmo, and he was ending that report from Josh Becker from the Hazeldene bull sale. You're listening to the annual spring bull sale. It's 5-1. We're still looking at market information, and now for our weekly wrap of livestock markets, let's go to Auctions Plus, and with the details of what's been selling in Auctions Plus, Tom Rookyard said market pretty buoyant.
Yeah, that's correct. Even this morning in our weaner and yearling sale, we saw, you know, there was nearly 800 users log into the sale, and 80% clearance. Southern Queensland and Northern New South Wales are really topping the buying regions. They're sort of throwing their weight around. But price-wise, we saw some fantastic prices. There were light sort of weaner steers out of Boggabri making 599 cents. There was sort of 300-kilo heifers from Willow Tree that made 484 cents. There's a lot of strong prices coming through.
It just makes you wonder how much longer it can go before people start saying, oh, can I make a profit at the end?
I think that's right. There's people who, you know, have gone through 2.5-3 years of drought that are keen to get stock back in their paddocks. They're keen to sort of rebuild their herd. So there's people who are looking. They're not making a decision for the next 6 months. They're making a decision for the next couple of years. So I think that is what is really driving this.
And they've got grass in the paddock, and you know, the grass is free. You don't have to buy in feed.
That's right, that's right. And I think that's, you know, just takes a lot of pressure off people, yeah.
And what's happening in the sheep and lamb markets?
Sheep and lambs, very, very similar story. Strong buying from the central west of New South Wales and the Riverina this week. We've seen sort of, there's around 70,000 sheep and lambs offered online on Auctions Plus, and that's sort of been pretty consistent over the last few weeks. But yeah, and there's been quite a lot of interstate buying, certainly out of, you know, we had 30% of all the sheep offered from South Australia came into New South Wales, and 20% of the Victorian sheep came into New South Wales. We had, you know, unjoined ewes from just right on the South Australian-Victorian border purchased by a grower in Dubbo. Ewe hoggets from Jamestown in South Australia heading to a grower in the Riverina. So, yeah, people are looking afar for their stock at the moment.
And that's, they're all restocker buyers?
Yeah, that's right. They're all restocker buyers. And we've sort of seen that, you know, that confidence and that influence in the market. You know, first cross ewes, ewe lambs this week, they averaged $280. It's up 23 on last week. Crossbred stall lambs averaged $132. That's firm on last week. So the prices are, you know, very strong at the moment.
That's Tom Rookyard from Auctions Plus. Let's go to the market for Griffith sheep and lambs today, and Crystal Ridley.
Good afternoon. Numbers remain similar this hour with agency yarding 17,200 head. There's 14,700 lamb penned with 9,650 of these being new season. Quality was good with some excellent lines of fresh finished lambs available. The usual buyers are present competing in a fairly steady market. New season lambs fluctuated around firm with trade weight 18 to 22 kilos selling from 135 to 161. Heavy and extra heavies made up the majority of the offering and sold firm to $3 better. Heavy lambs to 26 kilo received from 159 to 175, while extra heavy weights range from 170 to 186. Carcass prices average from 647 to 730 cents a kilo. Old lambs followed a similar trend with heavy lambs selling from 154 to 172, while extra heavy weights ranged from 168 to 220. There was 2,500 head of mutton penned with merinos making up the majority. These sold from 137 to 178. Crossbreds reached 166 and Dorper ewes received from 120 to 150. This has been Crystal Ridley at Griffith from LA.
And that's our market information for today. Quite a few texts coming through, some on the live cattle. John says the Gulf Livestock won. He says that's just a horrendous disaster. Another text saying, why don't the ship's captain look at the weather report before they leave port, and another person commenting saying live cattle exporting is always a disaster. And on the Murray-Darling issue, we've got a text coming through on that as well, saying don't plough the ground, don't clear the trees, don't waste the water. Do some people want us to go back to years of squatters and huge pastoral leases and give up all that we've achieved in this land, and we should be looking to the future ahead? They're also saying, should we be importing food and then having to pay for that with education and services? You're listening to The Country. I'll be back on Monday between 12 and 1. We'll talk to you then. Have a great weekend.